From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, challenging cherished beliefs on each side of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. We talk with historian Avi Shlaim about his new revisionist history of the region based on documents recently released in Israel. Shlaim's book is called The Iron Wall, Israel and the Arab World. And we listen back to an interview with best-selling espionage novelist Robert Ludlum. He died yesterday at the age of 73. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The U.S. Department of Agriculture has banned imports of animals and animal products from the European Union. The effort is designed to protect American livestock from foot and mouth disease. NPR's Richard Harris reports.
Most American consumers won't notice the ban. It mostly affects pork products imported from Europe, and that's less than 2% of pork consumed in the United States. Beef imports from Europe are already banned because of the disease BSE, and most cheese and cooked products are not affected by the temporary ban. It is an attempt to stem the spread of an illness that affects livestock, foot-and-mouth disease. The virus can spread easily and can wipe out entire herds. Foot-and-mouth disease is not a significant human health hazard, and it has not been seen in the United States since 1929, but it recently spread from Britain to France, which is what triggered the USDA's ban on imports. Richard Harris, NPR News, Washington.
Attorney General John Ashcroft has given the U.S. Attorney for New York expanded authority to investigate all the pardons that former President Clinton granted on his final day in office. U.S. Attorney Mary Jo White had previously been investigating allegations in three pardon cases, but the Justice Department says she now has responsibility for looking into all allegations that political contributions influence the pardons. Clinton issued 177 pardons and sentence commutations just before leaving the White House. They included a controversial pardon for billionaire investor Mark Rich, who fled the country after being indicted in a fraud and tax evasion case. Motorola says it's cutting 7,000 jobs in its cellular phone division. It's the latest effort by the Illinois-based company to cut costs amid falling sales and profits. NPR's Jackie Northam reports from Chicago.
This is the third time in 3 months that Motorola has announced widespread layoffs. In December, the company said 5,000 people would be let go from its cellular phone unit. Another 4,000 jobs were to be eliminated from its semiconductor business last month. A spokesman for Motorola says the layoffs are a necessary step to stay competitive in the current business environment. Motorola has been hard hit by falling profits and slumping sales with a recent downturn in the economy, and it's been struggling to gain an edge after it lost its number one spot in the world cell phone market to Nokia of Finland 2 years ago. The most recent layoffs will take place by summer. Motorola says no more job reductions are planned, but the company is watching the markets closely. Jackie Northam, NPR News, Chicago.
Stock prices came to a mixed close today on Wall Street. The Dow Industrials gained 82 points to close at 10,290. Declines led advances in heavy trading of 1.3 billion shares. The Nasdaq gained 91 points. This is NPR News. Scientists have taken their deepest look into the sky ever with an X-ray telescope. The images released today show an infant universe awash in black holes. NPR's David Kestenbaum reports.
In 1995, astronomers took a now famous picture of the distant universe with the Hubble Space Telescope's Deep Field Camera and saw a haphazard sea of galaxies. Now astronomers have looked at that same inch of sky with the orbiting Chandra Observatory, which detects X-rays. Bruce Margon, an astronomer at the University of Washington, described the three most important findings.
Black holes, and black holes.
Some giant ones anchored the centers of galaxies, other dim ones sat in their arms. The images show the universe as it was billions of years ago. Margon says theorists may have a hard time explaining how black holes formed so early.
At the moment, I think such theories are not embarrassed, but are perhaps growing a little queasy.
Some of the black holes were so faint they sent only a single X-ray toward the telescope each day. David Kestenbaum, NPR News, Washington.
President Bush told a senator today that he will not require power plants to reduce their emissions of carbon dioxide. In a letter to Senator Chuck Hagel, a Nebraska Republican, the president said he'll work with Congress to reduce other so-called greenhouse gases, including sulfur dioxide, nitrogen oxides, and mercury. The president said the government should not require power plants to reduce emissions of carbon dioxide, which is not labeled as a pollutant under the Clean Air Act. During his campaign, candidate Bush pledged to reduce carbon dioxide emissions, which are believed to contribute to global warming. The president's letter said the cost of reducing carbon dioxide would contribute to high energy costs. This is NPR.
Support for National Public Radio comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Geraldine R. Dodge Foundation for reporting on biological resource issues.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When it comes to the faltering Middle East peace process, you may feel like you've heard all the arguments on both sides. But there are several historians who have been rewriting the history of the Israelis and the Palestinians with the help of new source material they've gained access to. And these new histories challenge some of the cherished orthodoxies on each side. My guest Avi Shlaim is one of the leading revisionist historians. He's a professor of international relations at Oxford University and author of the book The Iron Wall, Israel and the Arab World, which has been published in paperback. Before we get to his research into the past, let's start with the present. I asked him what he thinks of the prospects for peace with age-old adversaries like Ariel Sharon and Yasser Arafat in power.
Given that the two leaders are now Ariel Sharon and Yasser Arafat, the odds on peace must be very, very remote. On the other hand, it's worth remembering that Yasser Arafat signed the Oslo Accord with Yitzhak Rabin 7 years ago and sealed it with the historic handshake in the White House, and that he remains committed to a peaceful resolution of the conflict with Israel. On the Israeli side, we have Ariel Sharon, whose record has been one of consistent opposition to many of Israel's earlier peace efforts, like the peace with Egypt. So his record doesn't lead to any optimism. On the other hand, the political situation forces Ariel Sharon to try and resume the peace process. That's one point. Secondly, public opinion is strongly in favor of continuing the search for a final settlement with the Palestinians. And finally, Ariel Sharon is 72 years old. He must be concerned with his place in history, and he must want very badly to succeed as Israel's prime minister. And the only way to succeed and go down in history as a peacemaker would be to achieve a final settlement with Yasser Arafat.
I'm wondering if you've in any way given up on this generation of Israeli and Palestinian leaders, and if you're any more optimistic about the generation that will replace them.
It's very difficult to work up any enthusiasm for this generation of Israeli and Palestinian leaders. Yasser Arafat has been there for so long. He doesn't have very much credibility. The record of his police forces and security forces on freedom of expression isn't at all a good one. There are abuses by the Palestinian Authority and police of human rights. So he's not a very attractive leader for the Palestinian movement. On the other hand, there isn't a number two, there isn't an obvious successor, and when Yasser Arafat leaves the scene, then there would probably be a power struggle, mainly between the security chiefs. So I wouldn't be too optimistic that the next generation of Palestinian leaders is going to be of the kind that Americans and Europeans and Democrats of any country are going to be able to be very happy about or very enthusiastic about. On the Israeli side, it's very difficult to predict what would come after Ariel Sharon. After all, 5 months ago, Ariel Sharon was a very marginal figure in Israeli politics. He was almost unelectable because of his reputation for brutality, because of his indirect responsibility for the massacre in the Palestinian refugee camps of Sabra and Shatila in 1982. And yet, he won the last election by a huge margin over Ehud Barak. So we might see a new kind of Ariel Sharon, Ariel Sharon Mark II, who would be very different to the previous Ariel Sharon with whom we are familiar. What will come after Ariel Sharon is at the moment impossible to predict.
President Bush has thrown out Clinton's peace plan, and President Bush clearly doesn't plan on taking as active a role in the peace process. What impact do you think this will have on the peace process in the Middle East?
It's extremely unfortunate that President Bush has turned his back on Bill Clinton's peace plan. Bill Clinton had pursued an Israel first policy, which made him suspicious as an honest broker for the Arabs. On the other hand, very much in Bill Clinton's favor, he was completely engaged in the peace process and spared no time and effort to achieve a breakthrough in this conflict on the Palestinian track. His new proposals went a long way towards meeting the essential Palestinian demands for a settlement. They offered the Palestinians an independent state on roughly 95% of the West Bank and Gaza, with a capital in East Jerusalem. And quite a lot of progress was made between the Israeli and Palestinian negotiators just before the Israeli election. And just before the Israeli election, Barak suspended the negotiations. So I'm very disappointed that President Bush had said that Clinton's proposals were his proposals and they left office with him, and that they do not commit the new administration. I'm disappointed because they were very good proposals, and because President Bush also has departed from the commitment and engagement in the peace process to a hands-off position of leaving it to the parties to try and work out a settlement between themselves. After all, ever since the Madrid Peace Conference in 1991, America has been the manager of the Arab-Israeli peace process, and without an active role, it's difficult to see how the two sides would be able to reach a final solution.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Avi Shlaim. He's a professor of international relations at Oxford University and author of the book The Iron Wall, Israel and the Arab World, which has just been published in paperback. Both Israel and the Palestinians base their cases on their interpretation of ancient and contemporary history. And, of course, they come up with completely different interpretations. What do you see your role as a historian in this context?
My role as a historian is to give an honest account of the historical roots of this conflict. The historical roots go back a very long way, but we don't need to go back to biblical times or look at the ideologies of the two sides. It is enough to start in 1948 and the establishment of the State of Israel and the First Arab-Israeli War, and to give an account of the conflict which is based on a fair and objective understanding of the roots of this conflict in 1948. My role as a historian is to look at the claims of both sides, to look at notions, however cherished by both sides, subject them to critical scrutiny in the light of the official documents that are now available, and discard any notions, any ideas, any claims that don't stand up to historical scrutiny.
Let's take a cherished claim from each side and see what you have to say about it. Why don't you start with an Israeli claim that you feel you can dispute through your research into history?
Okay, one Israeli claim is that the military balance in 1948 overwhelmingly favored the Arab side. Israelis often use the mantra Me'atim mul Rabim, the few against the many. They portray the 1948 war as a desperate struggle by a tiny Jewish community against overwhelming numbers and arms of the entire Arab world. My research and the research of my fellow Israeli revisionist historian shows that in 1948, the Jewish forces outnumbered all the Arab forces, regular and irregular, operating in the Palestine theater, and that after the first truce, they also outgunned them as well as a result of illicit arms imports from the Eastern Bloc. So the picture of a tiny Jewish David fighting against the strong and overbearing Arab Goliath is simply a myth. In this war, as in all other wars, the stronger side won, and the establishment of the State of Israel and the Israeli victory in 1948 is not a miracle.
Well, maybe you can explain a little bit more how Israelis outnumbered the Arab forces when there were several Arab armies participating in the war, and Israel was comparatively very small.
It's very easy to explain that because I'm only talking about the balance of forces, the numbers of troops in the Palestine theater, not in the entire Middle East. You're quite right. There were five Arab regular armies involved in the invasion of Palestine: Egypt, Jordan, Syria, Lebanon, and Iraq all sent armies. But they were expeditionary armies. They weren't the bulk. The bulk of the forces stayed back home. Then there was the Arab Liberation Army, which was an irregular army funded and organized by the Arab League. And there were a few other smaller groups of volunteers, like the Muslim Brothers, who came from Egypt. But if you add up all the Arab troops in Palestine, they come to between 21 and 25,000 soldiers, whereas the Israeli side on the 15th of May 1948 had 35,000 soldiers. So the numerical balance was in favor of Little Israel.
Let's take a cherished idea from the Palestinian point of view and put that to the test of your historical research.
Fine. One major Palestinian myth or cherished notion is that they were simply the victims of a power struggle in Palestine and that everybody conspired against them. The United Nations passed the partition resolution in November 1947, which called for creating two independent states in Palestine, one Jewish, one Arab. The Jews accepted the partition resolution, the Palestinians rejected it. So they themselves rejected the main proposal for a solution, and they must assume their share of the responsibility that a peaceful solution did not come about, and that instead a war was forced on Israel, and Israel won this war. So the responsibility for the consequent refugee problem, the 750,000 Palestinians who lost their homes and became refugees, that responsibility must in part be assumed by the Palestinian leadership at that time.
Avi Shlaim is my guest. He's a professor of international relations at Oxford University and the author of the new book, The Iron Wall, Israel and the Arab World. Let's take a short break here and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Avi Shlaim. He's a professor of international relations at Oxford University and author of the new book, The Iron Wall, Israel and the Arab World. When you talk about revisionist history, the kind of history that you're writing, what's responsible for the revisionism? Is it just the point of view of the historian, such as yourself, who are writing it, or are there new sources, new information that's available now that is enabling you to rethink Israel's recent history?
There are two main factors that help to explain the emergence of the revisionist or new Israeli history. One is the availability of new sources. Here, it has to be said to Israel's credit that it has a very liberal policy in opening up its archives to critical scrutiny and thereby making possible critical books. Israel copied the British 30-year rule, which governs the review and declassification of official documents. So under the 30-year rule, we have a great deal of new sources that were not available before. And I have to say, in fairness, that not a single Arab country has a policy of opening up its records to independent scholars. So we have an asymmetry in the sources available. We have British, American, UN, and Israeli sources in abundance, but we have only very limited access to Arab primary sources on 1948. That's one point. The second point is the change in the political climate in Israel following the Israeli invasion of Lebanon in 1982. There was a broad consensus until that time, until 1982, in Israel, that all of Israel's wars were defensive wars. The Lebanon War was an offensive war by Israel, and there was a lot of dissent while the war was in progress. This had never happened before. After the war, there was a real debate on whether Israel is indeed simply the victim and simply a defensive party, or whether it has a much greater responsibility for the escalation of the Arab-Israeli conflict. And this debate and criticism of the establishment created a space in which the message of the new historians began to have much more favorable reception than earlier criticisms of the establishment had done.
Now, you had said that one of the reasons why you and your fellow revisionist historians can rethink the history of the Middle East is that Israel has a 30-year law. After 30 years, secret archival information is opened up to researchers. Can you give us an example of something that you learned from documents that were released only recently that caused you to rethink an aspect of Middle East history?
Yes, I can. I can think of many examples, but let me take just one issue. Why was there no peace in the Middle East in 1949 after the guns fell silent, after the ending of military hostilities. The traditional Israeli explanation could be summed up in two words, Arab intransigence. Israel's leaders wanted peace with their neighbors, with all their hearts and all their might, but there was no one to talk to on the Arab side. I worked in the Israel State Archives in Jerusalem, and I found that the files of the Israeli Foreign Ministry for late 1948 and 1949 are bursting at the seams with evidence of Arab peace feelers. The first peace feeler came from King Farouk of Egypt. Then there was the long-standing friendship and cooperation with King Abdullah of Transjordan. And immediately the war ended, he renewed the contact with his Jewish friends. And these negotiations between Israel and Transjordan continued literally until the day of Abdullah's death in 1951. And in many ways, the most interesting example that I came across is that of Colonel Hosni Zaim of Syria, who carried out a coup in 1949, in March, and he wanted a full peace settlement with Israel, with the immediate exchange of ambassadors, normal economic relations, everything that Israel had been asking for all along. But he also had his price. He wanted territorial concessions from Israel. My conclusion is that it simply is not true that there was no one to talk to on the Arab side. The Arab public was hostile to Israel, but the Arab rulers were very pragmatic and very willing to engage in negotiations about a settlement.
Avi Shlaim is a professor of international relations at Oxford University. His latest book, The Iron Wall, Israel and the Arab World, is now out in paperback. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. And from Random House Incorporated's Delta Trade Paperback Division, publisher of Bibliotherapy, The Girl's Guide to Books for Every Phase of Our Lives by Nancy Pesky and Beverly West. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, historian Avi Shlaim tells us what he was taught about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict when he was growing up in Israel. And we remember best-selling espionage writer Robert Ludlum. He died yesterday at the age of 73. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Avi Shlaim. He describes himself as a revisionist historian of the Middle East, challenging cherished claims on each side of the Israeli and Palestinian conflict. His latest book has been published in paperback. It's called The Iron Wall, Israel and the Arab World. Shlaim is a professor of international relations at Oxford University. His revisionist history is largely based on Israeli documents that have been recently released. Now, you say that you wish you had access to Palestinian documents, but there isn't that kind of access available. What questions would you most like to resolve?
The central Israeli claim about the Arab side in 1948 is that all the Arabs who participated in the 48 war, who participated in the invasion, were united by two aims. One was strangling at birth the infant Jewish state, and two, throwing the Jews into the sea. And I would like access to the official Arab records in order to see what the true motives were, the true assumptions and calculations and aims were, because on the basis of the existing Arab sources at my disposal, the picture that I have of the Arab coalition facing Israel in 1948 is that it was one of the most deeply divided, disorganized, and ramshackle coalitions in the history of warfare. And indeed, that it was the inability of the Arab states to coordinate the military and diplomatic strategy which in large measure was responsible for the disaster that overwhelmed them. I already have a great deal of evidence to show that the Arabs were divided among themselves, that different countries had different war aims, but I would like to have more really first-rate evidence on this issue.
Tell us more about what you think those divisions were about and what the differing war aims were.
There was the Arab states were loosely organized within the Arab League, but within the Arab League there were different groups. King Abdullah had reached a tacit agreement with the Jewish Agency about the partition of Palestine at the expense of the Palestinians. He wanted to gain control over the Arab part of Palestine, over what we call today the West Bank, and after the dust had settled, to live in peace with the new Jewish state. So a Jewish state was part of his scenario, part of his plan for the settlement after the war in the Middle East, whereas King Farouk was worried about the prospect of the territorial expansion of King Abdullah and the growth in his power and influence, and therefore he wanted to curtail Transjordanian territorial expansion. So these two countries were at loggerheads. Similarly, King Abdullah was very ambitious, and he had a project of Greater Syria, which would have included Transjordan, Syria, and Lebanon, and he wanted, of course, to be the ruler of Greater Transjordan. So Syria and Lebanon regarded King Abdullah as a threat to their own independence, and they were reluctant to cooperate with him. The result was that there was very little operational cooperation or planning or coordination between the individual Arab armies operating in the Palestine theater. And this lack of cooperation, lack of unity, was a major factor in the Arab defeat in that war.
One of the subjects that you've investigated historically is the expulsion of Palestinians from Israel in 1948. And I'm wondering what things you've come to challenge in the way Israelis and Palestinians describe their parts in that history.
The real expert on the Palestinian refugee problem is Benny Morris. He wrote a classic book, The Birth of the Palestinian Refugee Problem, 1947 to 1949. His conclusion is that there were many different factors that accounted for the Palestinian exodus. But the single most important factor was the Israeli actions in 1948. So, and that, of course, contradicts the traditional Israeli version that Israel called upon the Palestinians to stay and assured them that they would not be harmed. And it was their own leaders who asked them to retreat, to withdraw, with the promises that they would return in the wake of the victorious Arab armies. So Benny Morris's research discredits the traditional Israeli version of how the Palestinian refugee problem was created. And all that I've read on this subject supports the conclusions of Benny Morris.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Avi Shlaim, who describes himself as a revisionist historian of Israel and the Arab world. And his new book is called The Iron Wall, Israel and the Arab World. He's a professor of international relations at Oxford University. Avi Shlaim, you're Jewish. I'm wondering if you ever lived in Israel.
Yes, I did. I lived in Iraq as well. I was born to a Jewish family in Baghdad in 1945. And in 1950, my family moved to Israel as part of the Iraqi Jewish exodus in that year. I grew up in Israel. I went to school in Israel. I did national service in Israel. But I had all my university education in Britain. And I've only taught in British universities. I've never taught in Israeli universities.
Do you still have family in Israel?
I still have family in Israel. My mother lives there and a sister. And I have many, many friends in Israel.
Growing up in Israel, you must have grown up with a certain point of view about Israeli history. I'm wondering if there's any one aspect of Israeli history that you learned that you always believed was just a fact about Israeli history that you've since come to challenge, something that you haven't yet mentioned.
That's an interesting question. I was a schoolboy in Israel, and I was taught at school the traditional Zionist version of the conflict with the Arab world. And specifically, about 1948, I was taught at school the heroic version of the few against the many, and also the view that Israel held to much higher moral standards than its opponents. The notion of Tohara Neshek, the purity of arms, that arms must be only used for defense. Not only was I taught all these traditional notions and the notion of Arab intransigence and fanatical and implacable Arab hostility towards Israel, I believed them and never questioned them for one moment until much later in life I started doing research in the archives and discovered a very different, a much more nuanced and complex picture. Some of my Israeli critics think that I'm selective in my approach, and I am particularly happy when I come across a piece of evidence which shows Israel in a dark light. This isn't so. I don't have any prejudice against Israel, nor am I looking for evidence to discredit Israel. I've never, ever questioned Israel's legitimacy. I don't think that some of the Israeli actions in 1948, like expelling Palestinians, calling to question the legitimacy of the state of Israel. My job as a historian is to look objectively at the evidence and to reach my own conclusions.
My guest is historian Avi Shlaim. His latest book is called The Iron Wall, Israel and the Arab World. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
My guest Avi Shlaim describes himself as a revisionist historian of the Middle East. His latest book is called The Iron Wall, Israel and the Arab World. He's a professor of international relations at Oxford University. The title of your book, The Iron Wall, comes from something that was written in 1923 by Zev Jabotinsky, who you describe as the founder of revisionist Zionism and the spiritual father of the Israeli right. What did he write in 1923 about the Iron Wall? What was his concept?
Zev Jabotinsky, in this article, The Iron Wall, in 1923, said that a voluntary agreement between the Jews and the Arabs is not possible. The Palestinians were not a rabble, but a nation, and no nation in history had ever voluntarily made way for another nation. So there was no way that the Palestinians would agree willingly to share the land with the Jewish state. There was no way that they would agree to an independent Jewish state in their midst. It followed from this analysis that the only way to achieve the Zionist aim of an independent Jewish state in Palestine was unilaterally and by force. What Jabotinsky suggested is that it would be necessary to create an iron wall of Jewish military strength, and the Arabs would bash their heads against this iron wall. They would try and obliterate the Jewish community, and they would try and fail repeatedly until they give up any hope of eliminating Israel from the map. But the important point about Jabotinsky is that he also had a theory of change. He didn't advocate accumulating military force forever. His main point was the need to negotiate with the Arabs from a position of unassailable strength. Once that point had been achieved, he wanted Israel's leaders to proceed to stage two, which was negotiations with the Palestinians about their rights and status in Palestine.
And one of your points is that you think the Israeli right today has adapted the Iron Wall as a permanent way of life, as opposed to one stage in the process toward peace.
My account suggests that the history of Israel is a vindication of the strategy of the Iron Wall, but you have to move to stage two. The first Israeli leader to transcend the Iron Wall was Yitzhak Rabin in signing the Oslo Accord with the Palestinians. But his right-wing successors, Benjamin Netanyahu, tried to put the clock back and to return to the Iron Wall and not to go forward on the political front with the Palestinians. That's, in a nutshell, my criticism of the Israeli right.
You grew up in Israel, but you live and teach in England. And I'm wondering what aspect of the British involvement in the Israeli story you find most interesting and that information that you're challenging.
The most interesting aspect as far as British involvement in Palestine is concerned is what was Britain's aim in the twilight of the mandate over Palestine between November 1947, when the UN passed the partition resolution and the proclamation of the State of Israel on the 15th of May 1948. This is one of the main bones of contention in the debate between the old and the new historians. The old Zionist historians claim that Britain never accepted the partition of Palestine, never accepted a Jewish state, but on the contrary, encouraged and armed her Arab allies, and particularly King Abdullah of Transjordan, to invade Palestine and to destroy the infant Jewish state at birth. My own research and the research of Ilan Pape points in a different direction. It suggests that Britain pragmatically accepted the inevitability of a Jewish state, but was determined to prevent the establishment of a Palestinian state, because the Palestinian leader was the Grand Mufti, Haj Amin al-Husseini, who was a renegade who had thrown his lot in with Nazi Germany during the Second World War. So in British eyes, a Palestinian state was synonymous with a Mufti state. And hostility to the Mufti and to the idea of an independent Palestinian state was a permanent and important feature of British policy during that period. So if there is a case against Britain, the case is not that he tried to prevent the establishment of a Jewish state, but rather that he tried and succeeded in aborting the birth of a Palestinian state.
My experience is that Jewish Americans are often very emotionally involved with the story of Israel and feel very strongly politically in whichever point of view that they have. I'm wondering if there's an equivalent in England, if Israel is such an emotional issue for Jewish people living in England.
No, there is a real contrast between the American Jewish community and the British Jewish community in relation to Israel. The British Jewish community is very low-key and doesn't stand up and defend Israel in the way that American Jews have a tendency to do.
Why do you think that's true?
The British Jewish community is much more concerned with internal issues of the community in Britain and the status of the community in Britain and ethnic relations, relations with Muslims and Christians inside Britain, than they are in issues relating to foreign policy and to the peace process. There isn't an intense debate about Israel within the Jewish community in Britain, as far as I am aware. The real contrast is between Israel and America. In my experience, Israel is a much more liberal and open society, much more open to criticism than America. America is a democracy and there is freedom of speech on all issues. But when it comes to Israel, then there is a real inhibition about standing up and criticizing Israel openly. And in my experience, the greatest resistance that I have encountered to my views was when I was spent a year doing research in Washington, D.C. in the early 1980s, there was strong resistance to airing different views about Israel, and argument and debate were not encouraged. And it would be good if American Jews copied the Israeli example of greater openness in debating historical issues.
Avi Shlaim, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much. It's been a real pleasure.
Avi Shlaim is a professor of international relations at Oxford University. His latest book, The Iron Wall, Israel and the Arab World, is now out in paperback. Coming up, we listen back to an interview with best-selling spy novelist Robert Ludlum. He died yesterday. This is Fresh Air. Robert Ludlum, the best-selling espionage novelist, died yesterday at the age of 73. Conspiracies, secret governments, terrorists, and spies were the stuff of his novels. He liked to keep his readers in suspense. Book critic John Leonard once wrote, "Ludlam tells his story like a man who must get it done before the house burns down around us. I sprain my wrists turning his pages." Ludlam's novels include The Bourne Identity, The Parsifal Mosaic, The Holcroft Covenant, and The Icarus Agenda. I spoke with Robert Ludlam in 1988. Now, you know, there's American and British traditions of espionage writing. Do you think there are any differences between the way Americans like yourself and the way the British writers like Le Carré write about the subject, write the genre?
Yeah, I think there's a difference. I think that they can be more obviously cerebral than some of the American writers of the genre that I have been identified with. Cerebral in the sense of introspection. I try to show introspection without really talking about it that much. But they have their doubts, their self-doubts, are expressed more voluminously than I do. I try to do it in quick brushstrokes so that you see the pain through the introspection, because I think if somebody is that introspective, he wouldn't be in the business he's in. And that's why I do it my way.
Do you have inside sources that you cultivate in the CIA or in government who give you interesting information?
Oh, yeah, there's Daffy Duck and Bugs Bunny. And, no, not really. I must say that several people I went to college with have ended up in allied intelligence circles, and they still remain great friends of mine. I've never asked them, nor would they violate anything, but sometimes if I'll call them up to just say, "Hey, blank, what do you think about so-and-so?" And if they laugh too hard, then I figure I'm getting near a target. But that's about it. I know. It's mainly imagination.
I read in one place that you ran away from home at the age of 14 to join the Marines, to lie about your age and join the Marines. And another place I read that at the age of 14 you ran away to be in the theater. I'm not sure if either of those things are true.
Well,
so maybe
there's a grain of truth in all of it. But, you know, it's like today everybody says, "What a successful actor I was." Well, that is totally nonsense. I mean, I barely survived as an actor. But it's true. I did not run away from home. I left home. And I left home originally to go on the stage. I was in Junior Miss and Janie in the Chicago, New York companies. And it's true that I did not join the Marines then. What I did was I tried to enlist in the Royal Canadian Air Force. And I was using another name. I was using the name of Holmes because anyway, I used the name of Holmes, and I was in the recruitment center in Toronto. I'd left the show and had my understudy take over. And by that time, there was word out on me, and somebody shouted out, "Ludlam?" I said, "Yes, no, out." That was the end of my career in the RCAF. I did, however, the next year. I went back to school, and I did, however, the next year enlist in the Marines. I think it was on the day before my 17th birthday or something like that. I was in prep school and simply decided that, you know, everybody else was winning the war, why can't I? And so I joined the Marines at 17.
So did you see much action?
No. I don't go into that. I was in the South Pacific, but in such a minor way compared to other people, I don't even, you know, don't go into it. It's silly.
Well, you mentioned before that you started your career as an actor, and I must say you really have a terrific voice. What kind of roles did you play when you were acting?
I either played homicidal killers or lawyers, and I've always thought there was a very definite connection. I was the guy that sent Siobhan McKenna to the stake in St. Joan, and he was a lawyer, of course. And then the next show I did on television, I can't even remember the name of the show now, but I think I was considered schizophrenic, paranoid, dangerous, and I'm not sure I was electrocuted, but I certainly should have been. I think both for the acting and the role, but nevertheless, it was.
Now, you did commercial voiceovers for a while, too, right?
Yeah, I know. It's morally one step below theft, but when you have a couple of kids in college, it doesn't hurt. No.
What kind of commercials did you do the voicing for?
Well, let's see. You know, there's so many that you do, and there's so many that you try out for. You're never quite sure. I do know that I was the voice of Braniff Airlines. You remember, you'll like flying Braniff style. And then, of course, there was the one years ago, I think I did it, I'm not sure, but "Should a gentleman offer a lady a Tipperillo?" And then, of course, there was the "Plunge works fast." Let's not go into that. But no, it was thanks to a lovely agent. You know, people kept saying to me when I was an actor, boy, you'd make a terrific producer. And I got the message, you know, get off the stage. And so I did and became a producer. But when I did make the switch to, and when I decided I really wanted to spend full time as a writer, to which my wife, who's a superb actress, thought she won. She immediately thought she'd have to go back to work. She said, well, you're 40 years of age, Robert, and you might as well try it now, no matter how impoverished we may be. But I did have the voiceovers going, and I'm eternally grateful for it.
So when you dropped acting at age 40, what made you think you could actually write?
Well, I've been writing. I've been a closet writer for years. When I was coming back from the South Pacific, I wrote a book that I'm afraid on discharge, myself and several friends over-imbibed at the Top of the Mark in San Francisco, and I lost an 800-page manuscript. And to this day, I say to people, they say, my God, you really lost a manuscript like that size? And I always say, yeah, you never remembered Naked and the Dead? I don't think Norman really appreciates that story, but it's true.
Why did you want to write international thrillers? Why did you start with that?
I didn't really start thinking I'm going to do that. And to this day, I don't label myself. I think I write suspense fiction. But then, you know, so's the Iliad and the Odyssey. I think it probably comes from the theater. Suspense. If you don't want to know what happens in Act Two after Act One, your play's going to close, and you're going to be on the unemployment line next Monday. And my unemployment number was 1344. I'll never forget it. So I think that idea of suspense comes from a theatrical background, from the theatrical experience.
Well, speaking of your theatrical experience, were you able to use acting in character development, since you knew about what it meant to get inside a character and how a character needed to be developed?
Yeah, I think so. I don't think so particularly, you know, consciously. I think that's just part of where I come from. If you're going to try to get inside the head of somebody, I suppose you act it out in your imagination. I mean, I don't go around shouting Arabic or something like that, or Hebrew, when I'm trying to describe something in the Middle East. But yeah, you try to get in the heads of people, and you try to use the only tool you've got, which is imagination.
Novelist Robert Ludlum, recorded in 1988. He died yesterday at the age of 73. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
In a recent article on contemporary thrillers, New York Times book critic Janet Maslin wrote, "There's no better reason than Mystic River to stay home with a good book." On the next Fresh Air, we meet the author of Mystic River, crime writer Dennis Lehane. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.